You were talking about phenomenology.
I was talking about phenomenology and how Proust really got into how you perceive relations. Hey, how you perceive relations, how you perceive... He's the ultimate modernist, but he brought in the science of how we evaluate perceptions.
Yeah.
And that was just a real big thing. It was much bigger than people realize. And then you got, you know, Husserl. And,
Hold on, let me bring it back to Gertrude Stein.
Yeah.
Neither a naturalist nor a surrealist, she had no interest in either the representation of social reality or the weaving of symbols, no interest at all in myth, metaphor, allegory, literary allusions, uncommon vocabulary, synoptic cultural critiques, shifts in point of view, or much else that preoccupied writers such as Joyce, Thomas Mann, and Marcel Proust.
Thank you.
So there you go.
Thank you. Well, it's good to be verified, or at least by an authority.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And but again, you know, this guy just came in and bought Mark Twain, and I'm reading Huckleberry Finn right now, and I mean, his attention to the linguistics of Missouri, central Missouri, is just spectacular, you know. And yeah, he brought a scientific eye to... But again, anthropology was big. Science was big in the 19th century.
Yeah.
Anthropology was the killer.
What you were saying about Cézanne, actually, I was going to bring up. Because have you heard that thing about why the most shades of any color we can see is in green? That's been proven scientifically because that's the most... It's the easiest for us to see predators. So you can... Because there's constantly different shades of green. But... Every color should technically have lots of shades like that, but we just can't see it the same.
That is, makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Makes so much sense. But there is a lot of green out there, too.
Yeah.
But no, it's true. When I stop at, you know, and coming back from the gym, and I swing on to South Fifth, there are five pine trees there. And if the stoplight is on, I look at these pine trees and the shades of shadow and light, and of course there's that glistening needles thing, so you're getting...
Shade shadow? That's an interesting question. Or is shade a different shade of a color? Or is it that color in a version of shadow? Does that make sense?
That's a perfect idea. You're absolutely right. It's our perception.
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, no, I kind of want an answer to this. Do you think it's more related to shadow, or do you think it's more related to the actual color itself? Like, is
they're mirroring each other, absolutely, yeah, that you can't separate them.
Yeah.
The reflection of the above bow and the shadow and the reflection of the top.
Oh, yeah. The reflection of darkness.
The reflection of darkness is our next novel.
Yeah.
Yes.
that's a sci-fi title if I ever heard one.
Mm. The reflection of darkness. Absolutely. And, yeah. Yeah, no, she was on it, and like, yeah, she stayed right there. As we talked about earlier, the only thing I've read of hers is Melanctha, which I really liked, and this was this endless variation of different ways of, you know, of her speaking. And, I mean, I really liked it, and because I love Cézanne, and I could see what she was doing. And she, of course, she bought all the Cézanne she could, you know. And just that way of, and if you write like that, Joni, you can...
She bought all the Cézanne?
She has several on her walls, yeah.
Huh.
And she's looking at them every day. But there's also this other perceptual thing that you brought up in terms of how we perceive shade and green, which I didn't know, is that if you start at the top of a page in a line, you can actually get, if the line is right, you can actually get this gradation of perception of either emotion or your own relation to somebody else, which Gertrude Stein was really big into.
Yeah.
And you could actually develop these shadings. And I was reading Melanchthon, and I was getting it. You know, I really enjoyed it because I like Cézanne, right? And I was used to that, just kind of...
So, cure my ignorance. Is Melanctha a specific reference to Cézanne?
That's a short story, or not a novella.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, it's not a... Yeah, okay.
Melanchthon is a black girl in Missouri.
Oh, right.
Now, Gertrude Stein grew up in St. Louis, I think, or lived there.
Yeah.
At some time.
I should know from her book here, but I don't.
She had definitely read Mark Twain, and she definitely read Huckleberry Finn, and saw what Twain was doing with dialect, and so
that I would say that's true. I mean, yeah. I mean,
it's great you came in here, because I just picked up Huckleberry Finn because this lady brought some old books in. So I just started reading Huckleberry Finn. And it's like, okay, I'm there, man. I'm in mid-America. Gertrude Stein grew up in mid-America. Might have moved to San Francisco, but I mean, just being in the middle of that, where you had like 20 different dialects within 100 miles, you know.
And that's amazing. It's definitely something that's going from the world. Like, there used to be something like on the measure of, I don't know, but like thousands and thousands of languages, and there's a language lost every day or something equivalent to that
in America.
well,
it probably dialects. Happened 20 years ago.
Is a dialect a language? In a certain sense, it is.
Oh, it's the only one, because if you look at life as relativistic, where you are is where you're going to speak, right? You know, and that's what I find interesting about Idaho. I mean, I'm trying to get this dialect. We've got a few dialects here, and basically, you know, like I've joked in the past, I knew a guy when I was running a golf course that violated 3 rules of grammar in only 2 words. And I had it figured out once, but I can't remember what it was. But it had something to do with he done or something, right? You know? And you have to talk like that to sell cars in southern Idaho, you know? You've got to talk like a cowboy. And because Idaho was colonized by the South, not by northern liberals, man. You know, there are a few here and there, maybe a few bankers here and there, or lawyers or judges, but most of them are from the South, man. All the working people are from the South.
Well, I wonder if there wasn't more incentive to lean into a regional dialect than there is anymore. I don't know. Because I think about today, and I don't see it as being a... I don't think it would be an interesting thing to try and write out.
That's the point I was making. There are no more regional dialects like Southern Idaho. There's just a kind of McDonald's cowboy dialect.
Yeah.
Whereas, I've seen him come down the road, you know, and I mean, but there's no richness of language. There are no idioms, you know, like in Mark Twain.
Yeah.
You know, I've been reading River No Return by Court Conley and Johnny Carey, you know, the whole folk history of the Salmon River, and you can't believe the one-liners he comes up with that people talk about, you know, that people used to use. And it makes the book so wonderful.
I think you invented a one-liner yourself, McDonald's cowboy accent. That to me is like perfect. I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what that is. Exactly. McDonald's cowboy. Yeah.
And it's currency. Like, okay, I've been accepted by the people who think like me. You know?
Yeah.
So here I am.
I get my Egg McMuffin in the morning, and then I go wrangle cattle, and I never butcher them, but, you know.
Exactly, man. But it's all, makes people feel comfortable, they're acceptable, they're going to talk like people like. You know, that's what about you and I. I mean, we go into a bar, we're going to talk pretty much like we want to talk. And you get...
Either that or I'm not having fun in that bar.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, it's really nice to pull their tails, man, because it's all going to be, I done, I seen it. Yeah, I know that, yeah. But none of the richness of the real, like you say, local colloquial dialects and the one-liners that have been saved from generation to generation, you know, to use at the right times, you know, like that road went up a hill like a shoelace, you know. You never hear that. I got that out of the Salmon River book. Yeah.
But
no, it's glorious, man. We're getting into some really good stuff now, man.
Okay. So I'm going to throw another quote about Stein at you. Something belongs to everything automatically, but nothing now is really convincingly a part of anything else. Anything stands by itself, if at all, and its connections are chance encounters.
Maybe. That's subtle and hard. Hey, that's subtle and hard to follow from the first line.
I mean, I think I got to give you some context. Well, it's talking about her emphasis upon style and temporal and spatial perspectives.
Right.
So she wanted things to take place in a continuous present. So
right. Right, exactly. Malangtha, yeah.
Something belongs to everything automatically.
Right.
But nothing now is really convincingly a part of anything else. Anything stands by itself, if at all, and its connections are chance encounters. So that's like the most nowness.
No, I get it. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually a syllogism. But it's got a premise and it's got a second one and then it's got the conclusion.
Yeah.
And yeah, everything pretty much stands by itself and it's just chance. You know what those relationships are going to be. Yeah. Yeah, no, she's great. I like her. She's done a lot. I just...
Her prose is frequently called musical because of its distance from expository language. But since words divorced from the demands of syntax and semantics are still words, that metaphor is inaccurate. Actually, it is more appropriate to regard such writing as an accurate analogy to atonality in music. Whereas composers such as Debussy and Schoenberg were abandoning the tonality of tonics and dominants, the standard musical syntax since the Renaissance, in order to emphasize the cohering capabilities of other dimensions of musical material, Stein had similarly eschewed conventional syntax for alternative emphasis.
Absolutely.
So that's like comparing her to atonal music, which is basically like saying, you're never going to read this unless you're... trying to get your PhD in Stein studies or something.
Or just enjoying sound.
Yeah.
Just enjoying
sound. Have you listened to atonal music?
Philip Glass is about as atonal as I
can. Well, he's not that.
But he's not atonal.
No.
He's extremely tonal.
He's very tonal.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? That rousing break, which was Mishima, Life in Four Chapters, that... Like, I mean, that...
No, all this stuff. Yeah, I mean there are limits, and but no, I really like that, and it fits into what we were talking before you turned on the mic, was that there are no followers of Stein, and Stein fits into no categories. She's not surrealist, she's not Dadaist, she's not modernist, she's not postmodernist. Mm-hmm. Like this guy said, she's not deconstructing anything.
Yeah.
She is just, like you said, in the now. She's a perceptual. She is just feeling and listening to human beings talking, right?
Well, you know, I think there's a relationship, there's a tangential correlation between her and cubists, which I think is kind of interesting.
I agree completely.
Yeah, it's like putting direct lines about here goes here, and then it's constant repetition, right?
Right.
It's like it's kind of like a fractal, but, you know, a fractal is an exaggeration of cubism. It's like...
Fractal's the wrong word, I think.
Yeah.
Fractal is infinite similarity through scale.
Well, that sounds like Gertrude.
But no, that has a similar structure all the time.
Okay.
And she's pretty much like fracturing. Fracturing is right, I agree with that, but I don't agree with fractal.
That's fair. I get that.
And the... But no, I really like to read her stuff just because of that. But anyway, going back to what I was saying is that she stands alone in her, she just is like, says, I'm going to do it this way, and no one has ever followed her, except maybe a couple of Castellans or one of the beat poets, you know, writing lines and just changing them a little or something, or reversing them. But you're right. I like the cubist. There's no doubt about it. The dislocation and of phrases and repetition of dislocations is very interesting. You know, I mean, I enjoy that.
Yeah, repetition of dislocations.
Yeah.
Well, it's at least
tantalizing. Well, at least rhymes.
Anyway. Yeah.
Makes no meaning. It has no validity, but it rhymes.
Yeah, yeah.
Kidding.
Which, to be a modernist, was put you in the highest echelons. If you can come up with a phrase like that,
yeah, I know, boy. Or a French.
I'm just working on my repetitions of dislocations over here.
Or a French post-structuralist. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Just say something, man. Oracularly.
Oraclearly.
And rhyme it. And rhyme it. Yeah, I'm having a hard time. Well, and it's hard rhyme to say. It. If you rhyme it, then you got it, man. Yeah. The repetition, dislocations, it creates its own form, right? So any repetition will create a form. It will create a pattern.
Of course.
Gosh darn it. You know, I'm really liking this Deschutes IPA you brought in.
Okay, so I'm going to throw another one at you. To put it differently, as purely abstract paintings represented nothing more than color and shape on two-dimensional canvases, so abstract writing is based exclusively upon materials indigenous to the medium of language, words that are unified by elements other than syntax and semantics. Thus, just as each new abstract painting is largely indebted to previous paintings, so Stein's prose refers largely to previous works of language. Which is kind of hard to parse, because isn't every sense of language heavily indebted to other parts of language?
Totally. But no, that was a soft moment in our great editor's introduction.
Yeah.
But I mean, it doesn't really tell you anything, because that's a universal concept.
Yeah.
And so read it again so we can see what, there must be some new meaning in it somewhere.
Well, it's basically just the first two differences, two sentences. To put it differently, as purely abstract paintings represented nothing more than color and shape on two-dimensional canvases, so abstract writing is based exclusively upon materials indigenous to the medium of language. Thusly, as per the first sentence, is only meaningful... has no meaning other than the sense of the sentence itself.
And the pattern, the arbitrary dislocation and placement and repetition of certain sound patterns or meaning patterns.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's wonderful, really. And that's what she was doing. It's a great introduction. I mean, I really like it. I really like it. And I prefer it vastly to postmodernism. You know, at least it's fun, you know.
It's
kind of like a puzzle, you know. You're just doing anagrams with language. That's and having true. A great time.
That's true. There is maybe more of a sense of play in it instead of a I don't know, what's your beef with postmodernism? I don't think you've ever
just the humorlessness of it. Yeah.
But isn't it specifically postmodern because there's a humor about modernism in it?
I'm just cutting through.
Hey, Scott. Good deal, man. See you. So, what were you saying?
Well, isn't it specifically called postmodern because there's a certain humor about modernism built into it?
No, I don't like the intellectual stance of arbitrarily... See, that's the thing about Gertrude Stein. She is eschewing, as you said, all these programs for just doing pure language, right? And I mean, I really like and respect that, but to toy with and arbitrarily and somewhat sententiously toy and manipulate previous narratives or styles,
maybe without.
And they stay with them, you know. It just doesn't interest me. I mean,
maybe without enough reverence. Maybe that's what the postmodernists are lacking, is like they not enough feeling of.
Right, I agree completely. Yeah, I'm.
Like, it's kind of mocking. It's kind of like, oh, look at the way they used to do this. And instead of saying, like, well, that worked, though.
Yeah.
Jonah,
you've got to know me well. Yes, exactly. You know, my primary feeling for art and literature is a pure feeling of just emotion and respect, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, postmodern, it's just too tricky. I mean, it's just like, I mean, okay, I'm just going to totally disrupt the narrative or turn it inside out and play games with it. Somehow it's different to turn the language around and get to get the feeling of a person, right?
Maybe your beef with postmodernism is that postmodernism isn't even a real thing, really. It's not even like
it's a decadent. It's a decadent. It's like mannerism in, you know, after Michelangelo. I mean, everybody starts mocking Michelangelo with these exaggerated forms, right?
This is actually very good, because that does help explain modernism a little in my mind.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Postmodernism, because, I mean, it is insane the amount of respect that modernist writers got.
Exactly. Now you're getting to the real deal.
Like the fact that they were mocked, it to me was like always kind of made sense, because I was like, it's insane. There's a thing from Hemingway's biography where he gets paid $5,000 for a short story, which equates to basically $90,000 today for a short story. Mm-hmm. And I just literally cannot wrap my mind around that. It's such a different world of respect for that medium. Yeah. Mm.
But he was also a media star.
Yeah.
You know, he was constantly playing to the media, constantly doing that, you know, and that's, if you read the biographies of Hemingway, that's the great tragedy of him. I mean, he kept talking about the bull, you know, the fight with the bull. That's why he loved the metaphor.
Yeah.
But I mean, Hemingway courted and celebrity and promotion constantly, to the detriment of his writing, of his family, of his soul, you know. Mm. He still managed to be a fairly good writer, but not really. I mean, after a certain point, I don't know.
I mean, a movable feast is only interesting if he's a famous person. A movable feast isn't really interesting if he's not a famous person.
Exactly. He's talking about people he knows are famous. It's still a great book. I love it.
Yeah.
The other thing I like about it is it brings out his kind of catty personality, which he hides, you know, in all his novels. He's this superior masculine, and in A Movable Feast, he kind of turns into kind of a gossip with kind of a smooth, beautiful style. And it is a beautiful style. I mean, I actually like A Movable Feast a lot. Yeah. He also didn't publish it, you know. He was just kind of sitting back there. I like A Movable Feast a lot. It's very warm.
It goes between
just kind of an innocence that he had for, like, how wonderful life was and everything. It's kind of like Camelot, you know. A Movable Feast is France when he is really didn't have much money. And he's hanging out with James Joyce and Gertrude Stein. Not bad company, you know, for a 25-year-old kid, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But just the fact that the wine was inexpensive, and you got to know people, and there weren't a lot, you know, there weren't billionaires everywhere.
Yeah. You know. I like the analogy to Camelot, but can you really defend it? I mean,
can I defend it? Absolutely I can, because Camelot is a metaphor.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And
fair point. Fair play.
You know, Jonah,
I'm out jousting. You and I'm pushed off my horse.
You know, that's the great thing about this. I mean, this is, I thought Camelot was 40 years ago in Pocatello, because there are all these great writers here. Now I'm just thinking, man, it's right now. You know, anytime you're really enjoying life and you're enjoying companionship and you're enjoying doing art, you know, and all this, it's always a great time. And I think that's how I'll finally defend what I said, is that for Hemingway, that time was that. And after that, it wasn't anymore. Now he's famous. Now he can bully people. Now he can ask for $50,000 per short story. You know, now, you know, some of his kids are going, you know, one of his kids going crazy. I mean, now everything's going all to hell, right? And he's writing this. And that's what I love about A Movable Feast, the nostalgia, you know, and the regret, you know. He never says it, but it's there. Once you know his life, you realize, yeah, he just is talking about this elegiac quality. Well, he's only 25 years old. You're talking in an elegiac tone about a time when you were 25.
Yeah.
It's pretty sad, man.
Yeah. You
know, we've had a little... We're
I was miserable when I was 25.
We're having a little bit... We're having a little bit of fun. I've always had a little bit of fun throughout my life, you know.
Huh.
And, man, yeah, the posing and the self-promotion and the money and the attrition on everybody.
Well, let's play a game.
Okay.
This is I'm going to start, and I'm cheating because I've already picked a passage out of Gertrude Stein that I thought was fun.
Great.
And I liked. And then you're going to open it up and read one and see if you have equal luck. Great. Which I doubt. But don't make fun of me. How sweet to tickle little sweet, and how prettily little pigs eat. And how interesting to collect treasures, and how admirable to celebrate pleasures. Napoleon was a great pleasure. A sonatina followed by another. The public is not invited to laugh. Who brought the turkeys to France? A Jesuit father brought the turkeys to France and ate them, and then they grew, and then we ate them, and then we grew. Let me see the cups. How often do we say, let me learn to stay? I stay all day and all night too. How can I be relished by lunches? How can I be stolen for tea? I cannot. How can I be earnest in churches? How can I be wise in a chateau? We say so.
Wonderful. Pure language.
Yeah.
Pure fun language. Oh, absolutely, man.
Now here's the game.
Yeah.
See if you can find one that's just as fun.
Well, the game is...
Pick at random.
The game is, it's a love... poem to her girlfriend, you know, and it's so wonderful and it's so playful.
Yeah.
And so I mean, I just love it. But yeah, it's a wonderful thing, you know. Yeah. Of course, we got to remember, man, she's hanging out in France, and that's, you got Rambo.
Do you know why she went to France? Like, well, I mean, Hemingway was a reporter, and oh gosh, I don't even know.
That was the center of all artistic in the Western world. Paris was the center of.
But how do they hear about that? It's just like gossip, and then you just decide to go.
Well, if you look at Paris between 1880 and 1920, you've got Bulgarians, Italians, Hungarians, Russians, English, Spanish, South Americans. I mean, how many South American writers lived in Paris? It was just everybody did not go to New York. They did not go to San Francisco. They did not go to Russia or London or Madrid or Rome. They went to Paris. This was the hot place, man. I mean,
and that's just I think that's just a level of randomness, maybe, or.
And no one. The other thing was, France was the America of the 19th century.
So they're riding that wave.
Every Jew, disenfranchised nobleman, you know, man or woman on the run. They all went to Paris. There is a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism in France, but France absorbed it. I mean, France was the country of refugees. All the losers, all the people that had to get out of where they were, they went because Paris, it was like San Francisco in a way. There was going to be some acceptance of them. You know,
you're talking San Francisco in the 1960s, not San Francisco today.
Right. And that's the point, is that's what Hemingway saw. I mean, it was San Francisco in the 50s when you can afford to live there. You know, you could get a cheap apartment. In the 70s, I had friends that lived there. They had cheap apartments. They were run down 19th century Victorian, you know, row houses. And there'd be six or seven there, and everybody's having a great time. But yeah, that's... Paris was just, and provincial Paris, no. I mean, provincial France, no. right wing, anti-Semitic, anti everything, right?
Right.
Just.
But you got to have that element because you have to have something to react against.
You got exactly so. You got to. You're right. And all these kids all came from. Very few came from Paris. All the great writers and painters of Paris usually came from outside. Not all of them, but a few did.
No.
But, I mean, that's the point. That's why, I mean, with all hell breaking loose, we have so much fun in America. I mean, there are just people from all over in this country. I just got my second chapbook from Blue Nose number 12, and this is, oh gosh, I threw it away. It's something like the Wild Dervish Press, and In the Garden of a Single Rose. I'm reading it, and I met him. He came through the store last year, Philip Odright.
Uh-huh.
I thought he was Hispanic, but now I'm realizing he's Muslim. You know, he's a refugee, man.
And he's just putting out his own, you know, he takes printer paper, folds it in half 2 times.
Yeah.
And there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Here, can I read this?
Oh, I would start at the beginning. The last one I don't like that much, but the first one I like.
Oh, okay. I like the title of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what I was going to say. Well, maybe we should just stay in Gertrude Stein.
Okay, yeah.
For sake of continuity.
Yeah, anyway, the point I'm making is that he's living in Tucson with his wife or girlfriend. His name is father must be English, I don't know.
Well,
but all I'm just saying is that this is a country of refugees, man. And Paris was the town of refugees. And you got tremendous, all the great painters, oh God, from Italy or wherever. If they do not move, if they are sensitive, if they are, got to do Gertrude Stein.
Yeah, yeah.
If they do not move, if they are sensitive, if they are sensitive, if they do not move, going as going, if they are sensitive, and as it can have been illustrated, if they do not move, going, and as it can be illustrated, as it can be illustrated, if they are sensitive. As it can be illustrated, if they do not move, as it can be illustrated, come together as they can be illustrated, and as they come together, and as they can be illustrated. So, 2 words.
Yeah.
Right? And that shows how over, you know, there's a limit, right? But still, there's a certain charm to it.
Well, that's why, yeah, it's like certain
and,
people...
And the idea, again, with illustration, of perception, this kind of ironic toying with as they can be illustrated, as our lives, as our emotions, right, can be illustrated.
Yeah.
I mean, as
to
sensitive,
the limits of illustration.
To the limits of, and then the word sensitive, she throws sensitive in, so you're thinking, yeah, I mean, we're all these creatures and we're constantly being illustrated by other people.
And you can't.
And I fucking hate it.
But you can't avoid
it.
You cannot. You can't
do it. I honestly like being a writer because at least I'm honestly, you know, illustrating other people, or at least, vestiges or perceptions of other people, you know. But at least I'm not illustrating them, you know, and talking about them. As you know, I never talk about anybody that I know.
You don't have time for that.
I don't have time. I got too much fun just, you know. But, yeah, no, that's the charm of that sentence. It's got some wisdom in it, right? You know, as it can be illustrated, as it will be illustrated.
Well, can you imagine sitting down the process and writing the word illustration that many times in a row? Because you also have to think, like, in a Chinese sense, like, every little letter you draw is like a part of what you're creating. And then, you know, I mean, she's really in touch with the word level, but maybe there's even a more minute level of like, how can you write that same word so many times in a row and not feel like you're just like doing your signature 20 times or something, you know, like when you're young and you try and perfect your signature because you're like, I want it to look right.
Right,
I'm trying to make this word look right.
Right.
But does it really matter? I mean, how many people actually look at your signature? You know, like, it, like you can just draw an X on there. No one cares, really. I mean,
I didn't read the second paragraph because it started with the word illustrated. I'm going,
right.
Come on, Gertrude. You know, okay, it's okay for one paragraph,
yeah.
But I can't do it for two, right?
Well, I mean, can you literally imagine writing that word that many times?
You all set, ma'am?
Yes, we are.
Great.
They're good.
But I haven't really, it's not like I'm going to read her that much. You know?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, this is you being positive, you know, just to be positive for the sake of being positive. should I say positive one more time? that would get really Gertrude Stein.
And positively.
Here's this is a real deep cut. Will is positive as positive as positive as positive. Her most famous line is, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose.
Right.
And then she has she was speaking at a lecture in America, and she said something to the effect of, that sentence has finally turned the rose red, you know, since Shakespeare or whatever.
I love it, yeah. You know. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, is it defensible, though?
If she thinks it is.
If she thinks it is, that's good enough.
If she thinks it is, and... you know, again, the possibilities of repetition in language are there. You know, it's just what are the limits, you know?
Mm, yeah.
What can you do? I mean, it's definitely
right.
Not.
Yeah. The possibilities of repetition.
And we have to admit, I mean, you know, there are people that have followed her, Robespierre, the French, you know, I don't know what he was. I don't know how he described it, but he describes a room for 20 pages, you know, I mean, and so, yeah, there are some...
that to me sounds like hubris, not like, you know, like, to think you're like, oh, I'm so good, I can describe this room for 20 pages and it's never going to get boring. Like, that to me sounds like hubris.
Exactly.
I don't know.
And that, you know, you brought it up, that's what you sensed my... aversion to postmodernism is this intellectual kind of cold stance that you take on life. Huh. And I'm just not into it, man. But so
we should take a turn into nonfiction. We should do that because you're into Mark Twain now. We should do the biography of Grant. Do the biography of Ulysses S. Grant.
Boy, that would be great, man. That would be great.
Here's what I remember from briefly going through it, to sum it up in case we don't get to it,
mm-hmm.
is he spent like 5 years trying to be a farmer. And then he failed. And then he goes on to be a general. And like in today's language, that sounds so insane. You're like, what? Like he tried for 5 years to be a farmer, and then he went on to be the general of the Northern U.S. Army. Like, it's so remarkable.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
Okay. All right,
great, man.